Thanks for coming out to Engineering the Future with Mushrooms and Diamonds and Vegan Meat. I'm Virginia Postrel. I wear a lot of hats, but I am here as the moderator because I'm a columnist for Bloomberg Opinion, and a while back I wrote a column which some brilliant editor gave the headline to Natural and Ethical or Getting a Divorce, and it was about the idea that sort of since the romantics of the 18th century, at least, there's been this tendency to valorize the quote-unquote natural as being more ethical, more positive, more good in various ways, safer, better, and certainly in recent years, better for the planet. But we're seeing a shift toward looking toward things that are highly artificial, that is, they are created by human ingenuity, but a lot of their appeal is, in fact, ethical and environmental. And so that led to the idea for this panel, not my idea, but a great one, at where we have three representatives of this trend. And the way we're going to do this is I'm going to allow each one in turn to introduce themselves, to show a little video explaining what their company is doing and how it fits into this story, and then we'll open our conversation. So I'm going to start with Dan Widmeyer from Bolt Threads.
Yeah, hi, I'm Dan Widmeyer. I'm the CEO and one of the founders of Bolt Threads. We're a biomaterials company, and we'll show you a bit more in the video, and I'll say a few words after.
Textile manufacturing has been one of the most polluting industries on the planet.
That's it.
Yeah. You said short, right?
Short.
Long. Textile manufacturing has been one of the most polluting industries on the planet. And in our resource-constrained world, every material matters. Inspired by nature, designing for the future. Bolt and sustainable materials to replace the ones that harm our planet and our future. Meet Microsilk, spun from the same proteins found and sustainably produced using fermentation. Microsilk is vegan and to biodegrade. Meat, B-Silk protein. Revolutionary clean beauty ingredient designed to replace silicone in hair care, skin care, and more. B-Silk is biodegradable and silky soft. And introducing Milo. A alternative to leather, made from infinitely renewable mycelium. Engineered to use less land, less water, and create less emissions than raising livestock. Backed by world-class brands. Milo is soft, supple, and animal-free. We are Bolt Threads. Way better materials for a way better world.
Well, and hopefully that gives you a flavor, minus the pauses, for what we do. We see the world as a 4 billion year running experiment of inventing materials that are perfectly sustainable and circular. and that with the right technology, with biotechnology, we can bring that to consumers and radically change what we're doing. We've got three materials here that are commercial, but we think of this as a platform-based business that can do lots of things. And one of the things I'm most proud of that we've been able to do is align the incentives of the economics of a business with doing good in the world of sustainability. So every time we improve, you know, some of the traditional metrics of a commercial business, our sustainability metrics get better as well. At least that's how they're aligned for the foreseeable future. And that's a really hard thing to do, but something that I think is absolutely transformational in how commerce and sustainability can work together. So I'll shut up for now, and we'll talk on the panel and ask questions of each other in a second.
And our next panelist is Mads Twomley Madsen from Pandora.
Hi, everybody. Can I just say...
Did I pronounce your name wrong?
It's very good that way. So this got to be the perfect Friday panel, plant-based burgers, you know, mushroom leather and diamonds. What else do you need to kick off the weekend? I head sustainability at Pandora. We're the largest jewelry brand in the world, and we sell about 100 million pieces of jewelry every year. And the story here today is about lab-created diamonds. We got a little reel. Let's see if tech is with us. So what we'll be talking about today is lab-created diamonds. So these are diamonds and created in a lab. They've actually been around for ages. So this is something companies have used for industrial purposes. But in recent years, the technology has made this come down in cost and perfected the look and the feel. So this is a diamond as any other diamond you would know. They're available now for more people because the cost is different, and then they're much better for the planet. So that's how there's a connection to what you hear about mushroom leather and plant-based burgers, and it's really about offering a new way of purchasing jewelry. So it points to a very exciting future. That's what I look forward to talking to you about.
And our third panelist is Jessica Applegren from Impossible Foods.
Hi, everyone. I'm the Vice President of Marketing at Impossible Foods. And for those that don't know us, we are a company that makes meat from plants to turn back the clock on climate change and restore biodiversity. And we are meat. Cue video.
We love meat. Red meat, cooked meat, ooh, bubbly meat. Meat with cheese on it. More meat with cheese on it. Meat being picked up by a spatula with cheese on it. Meat with cheese on it on a bun with a bun on top. On a plate. Impossible meat made from plants.
I chose that because the spot is called We Are Meat and super relevant to our conversation today. As a company, we're trying to expand the definition of meat to include an origin from plants, specifically because the way we make meat today is hugely degrading to the environment, and we really need to change it. We don't have the resources to continue that system, so we want to replace it. And the only way we're going to do it is making delicious meat. So thanks for having us.
So I want to start by... You know, these are all for-profit companies. These are not NGOs. They are not, crusades. And they may be crusades, but they are designed to make money. So let's start with the opportunity. And what is the market opportunity that exists in each of these fields that makes this commercially viable? And how do you, you know, how are you going to fill that gap? You want to start?
I'll kick off and say, I think of the opportunity as the environmental opportunity that we have. So we could actually turn back the clock on climate change if we were to transition from an animal-based food system to a plant-based food system. So 14.5% of greenhouse gas emissions are coming from the animal agriculture industry. So we can eliminate all that. And there's an added bonus if you rewild all the lands that we're using today to, you know, produce meat, that actual capture carbon, and farmers, eventually ranchers, could use their land differently to sell carbon offsets rather than, you know, do ranching for animals. And it's a win-win for the planet. It's a huge opportunity for the planet. And Gen Z is really sort of leading this movement. I think they're aware that meat in the future is going to come from plants. They want that. All of our data is showing that. So we see a giant opportunity for planet Earth should we, you know, make this change.
And so for the diamonds, it's, you know, the lab-created diamond market, it's there today. It's growing. It's growing quite fast. And it's kind of two drivers as we see the opportunity. So one is when diamonds suddenly cost about a third of what they usually do, it's available for more people. So the product becomes something that is maybe not just for the traditional occasions that you know a diamond for engagement jewelry, but it becomes something that can be used in more everyday life. And that's one dimension. So that's a different story around a diamond. The other part of that story is that it's better for the planet. And so we see, as you also talked about, particularly younger generations that are very conscious of the footprint that we leave on the planet. If you look at a lab-created diamond, it's a diamond grown in a lab. It's made with renewable energy. And that has a footprint a tenth of a comparable diamond from a mine. And it's the same. It's identical. It's not a lookalike. It's a diamond. So that opportunity is kind of two dimensions that are playing out, and we approach both of them. Yeah.
Yeah, I'd say at Bolt, we kind of fit in the same trend where the environment is mission number one. We founded the company on a belief that we were on a bad trajectory as a planet, and no one was doing a sufficient job of preparing for the very foreseeable outcomes from climate change when we started the company in 2009, and that someone was going to do the hard work of developing real things like materials that usually take 10, 20 years to make and bring to the market. So it really is driven around that mission. Everything we do centers off of that. Then we are a business. We have to actually make money at the end of the day. And we focus almost primarily on the fashion industry. We think of it kind of as places materials touch your body all day. And so when we look at these things, fashion's huge. We make 100 billion units of a fashion product every year on this planet. 10% of that or more never even makes it to a person. It just goes straight to landfill, do not pass go. It's all the inputs, human, environmental, all of that are wasted. And at the core, they're giant markets. And most people are looking for better. The designers want better. The consumer wants better. And all they lack is the way to voice that. And we're seeing it now when we bring things like Milo to the market or B-Silk to the market. Leather, and unsurprisingly, if you look at ecological harm, animal-based systems are like the worst of the worst as the token chemist on the panel, unless someone else is going to surprise me with their PhD as well. It's all thermodynamics and it's bad when you have animals. And so we see that we're kind of fighting the same fight as Impossible Foods over there with mostly cattle-based agriculture at the moment with Milo. But they're big markets. You know, leather's 35 billion square feet a year consumed on this planet. 300 million head of cattle going to slaughter every year to make 25 billion of that in hide-based leather. The B-Silk product is going into a beauty and personal care market that was mentioned in the video, if you caught it, for silicone elastomers. It's a $1 billion market of a non-biodegradable, strongly suspected, somewhat toxic product. This list goes on and on. Like, you won't be surprised by how many things you see in the world that are bad for the environment, bad for human health, and we think we can do better.
So let me ask you and Jessica to elaborate a little bit, because you have both expressed why somebody who is intensely concerned about the environment might buy your products, either as a business or as a consumer. But do they, I mean, is that the only reason? In other words, there's a lot of evidence that people say that they care about the environment until they have to pay a few pennies more.
Yes.
And I mean, you can see it with the price of gas, for example. Even in California, it's sort of like, oh, no, we have to get this price of gas down. Wait a minute. That's, you know, the whole idea of a carbon tax would be to raise such prices. Why would somebody buy your product? And also, how do the costs compare? I mean, we heard about the diamonds, but how do the costs prices to consumers or businesses compare?
Yeah, I mean, taste is the only reason that consumers, want to eat a steak and not a salad. Taste. It's the number one, value that we know we need to sort of hit. And when we launched in 2016, we didn't even talk about sustainability. I mean, we had this intuition that we would just have to win on taste and taste alone. So we partnered with chefs. We, really spent, I mean, had already spent, a considerable amount of time developing the first product. But from there, it's just a, constant improvement to make it taste better. So that's the reason consumers chose it in the beginning. But what happened in the years since was pretty interesting, right? Like all of a sudden, more and more awareness of climate change. You know, when we first came out the gate and said animal agriculture is a leading contributor to climate change, people thought we were a bit nutty. And that is now kind of common understanding. So we also have younger people caring more about sustainability, voting with their dollars. And so right now we're in an interesting point where we're going to start talking about it, where we, the consumer message was never eat this, to save the planet necessarily. It was pictures of delicious meat, eat it because it tastes good. But things are shifting pretty quickly.
When that's originally it's telling a sustainability story or an environmental story, it was a very niche market you'd sell to. That niche market has grown enough to support pretty
that's
big
right.
businesses at this point. Like, it's no longer like, well, you can't. We did the same thing. In the beginning, we didn't talk about it. We were like, the general philosophy was people pay for performance and sustainability is like a tiebreaker at best, but you need to be cost parity. Today, we don't expect a premium. We find ourselves getting paid a premium to deliver like what we deliver to brands. I'd also say in fashion, we have, I'm curious if this happens in food. When we make a product, the person we sell, we're making it for a consumer who's going to buy it and use it. But it's made by a brand, and the person who makes that decision is a designer at that brand. So like, our audience that you're actually trying to convince to use the stuff is actually pretty tiny. And those people care a lot, because they're like the gatekeeper to, what is it? I used to have the stat right at the top of my head. It's like 85-90% of the environmental cost of a piece of clothing or a handbag is set at the design stage by the choices the designer makes. And so, like, that person knows they're doing terrible things and want to do better. And so they buy into the sustainability mission in a pretty big way and want to lead with that voice. Now, at Bolt, we believe long-term that we don't bank on this premium. We build all of our technologies with some pretty simple ideas in mind. There's an economic structure to products that makes them work today for businesses. We sell to those businesses. We need to fit in that structure in a way that works for them. The diamond is affordable today with the structure of the jewelry industry. The Milo material we make has to fit in the structure of the businesses we serve for leather as well. It's going to be a big shift over time, we think, as this new technology comes in and is cost competitive. And we think over time, and I'm going to phone a friend here on Impossible, we think the technology and the product can be better than what's out there in the world as we have time as innovators to really innovate on something new.
100%. I mean, Pat Brown, our founder, says all the time, the cow stopped getting better a long time ago. We're going to get better every day, which is fun. But to the cost point, Virginia, We intend to bring the cost down to parity or below the cost of ground beef as quickly as we can. And we dropped prices 20%, and we saw that did bring more people, into...
Funny how that works.
Yep, into the Impossible movement. But it's an interesting balance to strike, obviously, because it is still... a premium product and compared to a premium ground beef, and how you sort of maintain that halo while also make it more accessible is something we're playing with. And it's interesting to compare between our three categories too, how price is a factor.
Yeah, and I actually want to sort of flip this a little bit. Mads, I hope I'm not going over your expertise, because you're not making the diamonds, you're putting them in jewelry. Yep. But one of the things that people have trouble grasping often is it takes a lot of energy to make lab-grown diamonds. How is it that they are more sustainable than mined diamonds?
Yeah, okay. So you grow diamonds in a lab, in a reactor, by taking a tiny seed of diamond and by infusing carbon-rich gases, and they kind of layer on the diamond piece. And so you get to the same kind of solid state of carbon atoms that are arranged in a crystal, and it is what happens underground over many years. But this can take place in a lab. What it requires is a lot of energy, and so when we set out to do this, we know that this has to be part of our journey to build a business that is more sustainable, more low carbon, circular. And so we have chosen suppliers that run this process with 100% renewable energy. At the outset, it was a little bit lower, but now as we're preparing to take this out in global markets, it's going to be 100% renewable energy. And so that's why you get a very controlled process. We know exactly where this is happening. It's in a lab in Europe or North America. And it's run on renewable energy, and so the footprint is about a tenth. We did a calculation on one of the first products that we were putting to the market, and we arrive at a diamond ring that will have a carbon footprint comparable to a quarter of milk, and so that's a new era of luxury mm-hmm. that you're getting to. I want to just come back to what we talked about also on the, why are consumers buying this? And I think it is, you need to qualify on the normal parameters, if you will. So people buy jewelry for very personal reasons. It's about memories. It's about personal expression, and that doesn't change because you change the material. It has to kind of live up to that. And so for us, what happens is we get this. It's actually the same material, but it has a different origin story. It's not dug out of the ground. It's grown in a lab, but it's a diamond. But we put that into still our universe or brand universe, which is about personal expression, collectability, and the consumer needs to relate to it in the same way as any other piece of jewelry. And then you get this benefit or the new story about sustainability, which is we see that Gen Zs and millennials react to very, very much. They're looking for it, and they see that as a story that is very, very valuable for them to connect with.
Right, sure.
One of the things I've admired, because when we think about sustainability and we call it corporate responsibility, we think it's multimodal, right? We think about carbon, we think about water, we think about chemistry, we think about labor. I think the diamond story is one of the best stories about traceability of a product and labor. Absolutely, Can you say something about that? Because I think that is just as valuable as the energy story.
So it's true. So of course, what happens here is the origin of the lab created diamond is very kind of traceable and transparent, because we can visit the factory, which is a lab, and where these diamonds grow, and so we know where each and every stone come from. We know the energy that has, and we could actually tell exactly where in the grid it comes from. So we have full transparency on the supply of a product where that can be a problem, and so it's a simpler process that is, for our part, we've had a primary focus very, very much on the climate side of things, because we see that as priority number 1A, moving our company to a situation that is low carbon. We're setting out to halve our carbon emissions for the next 10 years, not just inside the company, but across the value chain. And so this becomes part of that. We're shifting to recycled metals. We're now using stones like lab-created diamonds, and that's going to bring us to being a fashion company or a jewelry company of a next generation.
Yeah. Another thing that came out in my reporting with diamonds is that because when you make the diamonds in the lab, you can make them whatever size you want. Yeah. You don't make little ones. I mean, you make a range of sizes, but when you mine diamonds to get a diamond of a certain, so let's say a 1-carat diamond, you have to mine a lot, and then you end up with smaller ones, and that's actually some of the efficiencies come from that, which leads me into one of the distinctions in. I wrote this book it came out in 1998 called The Future and Its Enemies, which has a chapter about nature and artifice. And one of the sort of distinction I ended up drawing there was that artifice is under control. Nature is out of control. And one of the things that you're doing is you're bringing these processes into a world where there can be sort of consistency and control, and you don't have little bitty diamonds. And I wondered if you could talk a little bit about that. Beforehand, we were talking a little bit about Milo, so that was what inspired this question.
Sure.
Yes. So how do you do it, and what's the difference
I am going to wait with bated breath on what everyone else says in their parts on here. But what I can say is when you work with living organisms that you try to be in control, they would disagree vehemently with that
that
idea
exactly.
That we actually have any control
that's my
on the
point,
system.
Is that they're natural.
Any living organism, there's one thing in the world that doesn't want to do the same thing every time repeatedly, it's life. It evolves, it changes, it adapts, it's horrendously complex. It is the great challenge we face in every product we make, because somewhere in every process is a living organism growing and making the material, whether that's it's all fungus actually, but whether it's a strain of yeast in a fermenter making the bee silk, or whether it's filamentous fungus in those trays, we didn't point it out, but there were trays with these mycelium clouds kind of growing in it that makes the Milo. We put a lot of effort in how to design systems where we can take a pretty, in our parlance, a pretty wide process window upstream, and then convert it into what can be a high yield economic viable business of high quality material in the downstream. There is no universal truth to how to solve that problem. Right. It's just a challenge every time you do it, and a lot of smart engineer hours die on that hill.
But Milo is more consistent than leather.
One of the things, like leather, up to 40% of a hide gets thrown away. If you go into, maybe everyone in this room does sit around a leather factory, so I won't have to tell you. But when I look at a hide in the factory or in a cutting floor, there's all these marks of here's a vein that was too close to the surface, and here's a bug bite, and there's where it rubbed a barbed wire fence, and there's where it's a leg is in the way of the shape you're trying to cut. So all this stuff gets thrown away over time. And when we design process, we design Milo to be basically perfect continuous sheets roll to roll. It's actually made in a continuous process in our factory. Which is a bit of a trick because it starts with growing something and then it becomes continuous, and I'll leave the magic trick to your imagination for the moment, unless you ask me a question on that later. but the idea is that you get this idea of efficiency is a big part of how you build towards sustainability over time. And to speak to my opening comment, the more efficient we get, the more perfect the materials, the higher our yields, the better our economics, everything is winning here all together. And that's one of the things that gets me really excited about this alignment of purpose and business.
Jessica, it sounded like you could talk on this too. Yeah.
Oh, I mean, I love the topic of control. I mean, I think about the entire plant kingdom. We have yet to explore the infinite combinations that we can put together, and create flavors that are known to us, like we did with the Impossible Burger, recreating the taste of meat using heme, to the unknown. I mean, there's so much we can do with the plant kingdom to mimic meat, fish, dairy, and then create new categories, of food. So the control bit, I think, is what is amazing, that we have these knobs we can turn. If we want to lower the sodium, if we want to lower the fat, we can. And we can, adjust for any consumer preference or, coming consumer preference. So I think it's kind of part of the magic, of what the future of food is going to be.
I think that's actually a really interesting point you're making, which is that while we always comp these to things that exist today, it's because people are less creative than we all think we are. It's leather, it's meat, right? But it's like, it actually new at the core. And yes. I think there's a really fascinating, I see it every day. I didn't tell you guys, but I was looking at pictures of new prototypes from new brands. And I'm always in the green room back here, and I'm always amazed by what people come up with, because it's like they play with it, and these designers or creatives do things that you're like, you'd never do that with leather. But you did it.
That's right.
Because you got chasing it. And that's where you imagine new categories of foods and things like that. Like there's an unimaginably big white space in front of us if we perfect these technologies and go from kind of toddler/infant stage we're at now to something resembling a teenager, maybe.
Yeah. Did you have anything you wanted to add?
Well, so it's different because we don't have too much biology
Thank your lucky stars.
But I think so for us, the control part, it's also there. So we made a decision to turn all our jewels, silver is our main raw material. We decided to make sure we use only recycled silver, and there's an element of control in working with the supply chain and making sure that all elements line up so that we can, in the same way as you're talking about, tell exactly where's this silver derived from. And again, that will lead us to a better position when it comes to climate. So when you start changing the way you get to the materials, you have a challenge of control, right? Yeah.
And speaking of challenges, okay, you haven't taken over the world. You're all got companies that are doing real stuff, but you haven't taken over the world. You haven't displaced the traditional materials. What are the challenges or barriers that you face now, going forward, that you need to overcome in order to have a greater impact and, be more successful?
Well, Mads, you touched on something I think is really important, the sort of emotional connection mm-hmm. to these things that we are trying to replace. Mm-hmm. There's a lot to unpack there, but when I think about impossible, I just think our big challenge is awareness. Like, we still, so few people know about, our brand, our product, our approach. That's kind of the biggest challenge we're addressing right now. We need to, rapidly, scale that awareness so we get more people trying this. And so more distribution points, more global expansion, all of that is our biggest gating factor right now. We have a deadline of 2035 to completely transform the food system. So times, the clock is ticking right now. And I think just given the mindset of this younger generation, even younger than Gen Z, I think kids growing up today that are learning about climate change directly through school, I just think that orientation matched with really delicious, food products is going to be unstoppable. Talk to me in 2035.
Smooth sailing, as long as the kids come around.
That's so right. on the emotional part, that's one of the things that has to evolve. We talked to consumers. We launched initially in the UK, and what's amazing to see is that young consumers very quickly kind of built a new story for how they relate to a new material. And so when we ask them, do you prefer this diamond or diamonds grown in a lab, you see that very, very quickly younger generations relate to this as, well, I want this one because it's innovation and it's sustainability. And so there are some first movers on that, but there's of course also kind of a rollout of that to happen. And then there's a scale up of the technology. So providing the amount of stones that we need takes time. So that's also a time aspect.
Yeah, I can confirm that younger consumer thing. So I taught a class on consumerism and its discontents at Chapman University in Orange County. And 24 students, and we read Veblen, among other things, conspicuous consumption, and he has this discussion of why jewelry is valuable. Anyway, so that led to this discussion, and every single student said, oh man, I would much rather have lab-grown diamonds. So, and I didn't really sell it, I just said, there's this, and there's this, and it was very interesting.
Did you take some names?
I have the names. Yeah.
This is your stuff.
Yeah. So, Dan, I've been talking to you for many, many years. Why haven't you taken over the world yet?
Yeah. I think, and I alluded to this in one of the previous answers, right? This is a immensely powerful technology, but one that we are very immature at when it comes to understanding biotechnology as a primary engineering medium for non-pharmaceuticals, for pharmaceuticals. We're pretty terrible at it, in my opinion. But when we build out processes at scale, usually there's no existing supply chain of any way, shape, or form that we can tap into. We have to, in the case of Milo, we have to go convince mushroom farmers to grow mycelium instead of mushrooms, and then we got to go build a factory where we can manufacture the stuff. We're kind of on track to make 1 million square feet per year quantities of Milo right now, which we all get excited about, and we're going to go throw a little party. And then we go look at the total leather consumption at 35 billion square feet, and we cry into our beers. And so it's like this unimaginably large challenge. And we actually think the only way we're going to solve this in a time that is meaningful for climate change is that we're going to have friends on the path, that there'll be many technologies that can start to address this problem in the near term, and then we'll all see what works the best in the long term.
And I guess the flip side of that, though, Dan, is like the haters, right? There's going to be the friends, but the haters are out there. I think for all of our categories, there are definitely, forces out there that don't want us to succeed. And I don't think that that's going to be a limitation, but it's interesting to watch, that opposition coming for Impossible.
Well, particularly in your case,
I
think you've got, all of you obviously threaten incumbents, and that's always the case with anything new, whatever. But you have a cultural element to it, too.
Absolutely.
I can even see it in the voice you choose to use in your... There are people who see you as, judgy and obnoxious and, threatening them and puritanical. And so they push back. So how do you...
When they take out full-page ads in the New York Post saying that fake meat...
Ah, yes. This leads to the whole fake... we need to have a discussion of...
We do. And fake meat somehow is analogous with unhealthy and processed, and that was a concerted effort. There's an organization called the Center for Consumer Freedom. You should look them up. They're pretty interesting. But they also funded Super Bowl ads to try to convince consumers that this isn't healthy because it's a giant threat, So we clapped back with our own Super Bowl ad, and really, tried to raise awareness around, let's talk about meat being, animal meat being healthy. Let's talk about beef. Let's talk about what's in beef. Fecal matter is in the majority of meat that you're going to buy in the supermarket. So, there's a real conversation to be had if we want to have it. And I think we do need to sort of address these haters as they come and engage, because they're not going to go away. I mean, this is a huge threat.
Yeah. The cultural thing aside, this, you raise this issue, which sort of is how I got interested in this first place, that the idea that artificiality, that is things being made by humans, altered by humans, not as given, maybe working with nature, but still it's not, is first of all something new. In my book on fabric, I write about, cotton is not a natural fiber. And secondly, is something suspect. I mean, this is something that we've been inculcated with the idea for 200 years at least, and particularly for the last 50, that things that are authentic are not made in factories. How do you address that? And it's different for the diamonds, actually, but the two of you are, doing new materials.
I mean, we like to say, hey, you used to think the horse was transportation. Now you've got a Rivian, you used to think a camera needed film. Now you have your phone. There are so many examples of technology completely replacing, a whole system. So sure, it's suspect until it's just the new normal.
Yeah, I mean, I think we look at this as, you know, humans are nothing if not adaptive is one of our most favored traits over all of our history. And we almost never adapt through pure virtue alone. I can't think of many examples outside of religion. And so, you know what? New things are going to come up. People are going to change, and they're going to change because they have to. You know, I think the thesis for Bolt in 2009 was pretty simply, climate change is going to happen because we're not going to stop pumping carbon in the atmosphere. People will change their behaviors as they are more and more impacted by acute visible impacts, secondary impacts from climate change. And that will drive changes. And I think, I mean, not toot my own horn, but I think it's playing out as predicted from 12 years on. And so when we make Milo, we talk about Milo. We don't talk about leather. Like, it's a new material. Mm. It's going to have new uses. Mm. And we think that just, like, the inevitability is there, whether it takes 6 months or 60 years. And we'll find the niche markets, we'll find the materials, and we'll keep plugging along. And we want to be authentic and credible in that we are solutions providers for the future.
Right. That was an important decision that that DuPont made with nylon, was not to market it as artificial silk, which had been done with rayon with some negative side effects and people thinking it was fake. And so they just said, a new material.
Wait, are we going to nerd out on fibers history now?
We can do that, but I probably should keep it. So I want to talk about that. I'd like to have you look forward, let's say 10 years, and talk about where you see this going in two respects. You know, the general, where would you like to be? Where, how do you get there? But also, how would your competition be different in 10 years versus who they are today?
So, yeah, so so back to what we just talked about, of course, the diamond question is a little bit different because it's a diamond is a diamond. So it's what we're looking at is a future where, you know, our perception of what a diamond is will be very much about the kind of origin story. The way we look at it, it's not kind of fighting for this same existing market, but because of technology, this product, this piece of jewelry will be for more people. So it's a bigger market. It's a market that is changing, and so that's coming back to your question now, that the future we look at is a diamond market that is expanding. Consumers that wouldn't have considered purchasing diamonds up until now, we hope will begin to do it, because it becomes something that is stepping outside of the way the places where we usually see diamonds in engagement rings, and becoming something wider. And so the future is different in that sense, and the market is changing. And honestly, our approach to this is that we think there's a lot of opportunity to grow that, and so we focus on our piece. I think there is of course the dialogue, the narrative going on in an industry around, so what's the difference, what's better, what's but I think it will come down to a situation where we will have different stories around materials. You know, we can some will prefer the origin story of a diamond created in a lab and kind of created under the brand that is marketing that. So for Pandora, we're a lot about collectability. We're a lot about personal expression, affordable luxury, and so consumers that are attracted to that will be attracted to that, and others might choose other directions. And so in the meantime, of course, the industry will need to kind of come to terms with what happened here. But it's a new market. It's a bigger market, right?
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Dan?
I mean, I look ahead 10 years. My expectation is that we'll see our existing products be far wider distributed, not just in geography, but in price point, in types of applications. You know, today we almost all Milo goes into wallets and handbags and things like that. You know, I expect to see it broaden out into shoes and cars and other places. And then also, you know, the thing that drives us in our mission is we think that we've got this absolutely the most precious resource on earth that is irreplaceable is biodiversity. It took billions of years to create. If we destroy it, it goes away forever, and we don't have billions of years to remake it, because it's a random walk of evolving DNA. we want to be mining that and finding amazing new materials that are on par and exceed our expectations from Milo and B-Silk and everything else we can do over the next 10 years. And to the competition question, I hope in 10 years, and I don't know if I believe this will be true, but I hope that we're talking about competition with other people who are using the same blueprint we've used to build Bolt, making other materials, and making the world a better place.
I like that. The biodiversity piece is key. I think in 10 years we will see ranchers transitioning their lands from ranching, which is, you know, less and less lucrative, to, you know, more and more lucrative carbon markets. I think that the supermarket is going to look really different. It's going to look the same, except there's not going to be a sad, you know, your aunt's vegan aisle over here where, you know, no one wants to visit and what is that thing? That looks gross. The plant-based meat, the plant-based cheese, the plant-based, you know, everything will be distributed throughout. Kroger actually did a really interesting study that showed if you put plant-based meat in the meat aisle, consumers buy a lot more of it. You just remake the whole system to be plant-based, but keep the same look and feel. I think that my kids are going to be really proud that they kind of lived through the era that transitioned from one system to the other, and their kids are going to think it's batshit crazy that, you know, people cut down trees in the rainforest to plant soy to feed to cows to then slaughter and, you know, ship and then sell, and all of it is just it's going to seem really wacky, I think, to my grandkids.
I got to say, you guys are doing something right. I might not be representative in the People's Republic of Berkeley, but the Safeway has the plant-based meat in the meat section, and it's the only one that's sold out consistently.
Thanks. Thank you, Safeway.
So I want to open it up to questions from the audience, and we have a mic here, I guess.
Hi. Thanks for doing this, and I have one direction and two questions maybe. One for Mats. I'm a little bit concerned that you will internally in your company survive, because once you open up the diamond discussion, you open up the discussion around blood diamonds as well. So nobody talks on this surrounding here, but that's in my head. Oh. And then to Dan, did you ever think about doing brands on your own? Because your customers are not as crazy as they could be. Thank you.
You want to go first?
Okay, thanks for the question. Yeah. So what we do is we've decided kind of on what's the pathway for our company. And, you know, we set out a couple of years back to say we're going to go carbon neutral. We're going to cut emissions significantly. We're going to turn circular in the way we view materials. Right, so it's going to be about the materials that have to be we can recycle them, or they're derived sustainably. And so when we took that kind of view to things, that's how we begin to make decisions. And so lab-created diamonds is a lot about choosing the pathway that is best for that. And so as we did that, we decided we won't use mined diamonds anymore. So it's outside of our scope of business, basically, right? And so I'm not an expert on how other companies arrive at diamonds. What we decided was that this is the way for Pandora. And so we can see there's a lot of discussion about the industry when we talk. Frankly, that's up to other stakeholders to do that. Businesses.
I will say with my students that I mentioned, that was the blood diamonds and the general issue of labor and mining was one of the reasons they liked the idea of lab-grown diamonds.
To briefly answer the question on being vertical, we have been in our past. To give you the short version of the long story, we're not afraid to go all the way to the consumer because we think that's who we ultimately serve. And we try to do today, the idea is we try to do experiments to try and understand what the consumer loves or doesn't love about a material so that we can be better providers to existing large-scale brands. The short version of why we don't do big vertical stuff today is it's just beyond the focus of what a startup can do. Like, you just don't have enough resources to win at two things at once.
Yeah.
All right. So, hi, I'm Nico. I'm a culture strategist at a trend forecasting agency called Fashion Snoops. And I have a question for Dan. I've actually been following the rise of Milo for some time. I'm a bit of a fungal enthusiast. You know, we're always directing our clients to your biomaterial innovations, so thank you. But my question is in regards to, there's this whole subculture of Gen Z creators on TikTok who are creating biomaterials. Mm-hmm. And I've seen a lot of them creating SCOBY leather, which for people who don't know, SCOBY is a symbiotic culture of yeast and bacteria, and it's found in kombucha, so sometimes they call it kombucha leather. So I was wondering if you guys are looking into that as a material at Bold Threads, and if that's a viable biomaterial on a mass scale.
So yeah, we look at lots of things because we see ourselves as a platform, and we have over time at the lab scale, made north of 10,000 different materials that we think are cool from the biosphere. We've probably bought about a dozen of those to multi-kilogram scale, where we can like actually make a product and be like, wow, that's the world's worst shoe, never do that again, right? Like, which is usually the outcome, is usually this is terrible, never do that again. That's kind of how science works. The kind of kombucha type of SCOBY leather product is interesting, difficult to scale, difficult to meet quality needs, very cool artisanally. Part of our Milo story is how do you build something that you can make millions and billions of square feet that meet the quality expectations of brands and consumers alike while also being true to our sustainability roots? And it's a topic of fierce debate regularly within the business.
Yeah. My name is Chris. Two questions about Milo. Does it have industrial applications or is it just fashion?
For the moment, fashion because of speed to market.
Okay. Can it be fabricated in other shapes other than sheets? Can it be fabricated with spheres, tubes, toruses?
Ooh. Yes.
Well,
but not the way we do it today. But that's one of the, when we talk about new technologies, there's like this concept of new technologies we call an S-curve, right, where you start slightly inferior to the incumbent product you're competing with, and over time, as a function of effort, you get disproportionate gains. One of the things is making it in forms other than sheets for specific applications. Doing 3D forming and things like that is particularly fascinating to us.
Okay, thank you.
Hi, my name is Elliot, and my question is mainly for the Impossible and Milo or Bold Threads use cases. So you work primarily today, I think, with plants, fungi, like sort of proteins derived from like whole organisms and things like that. Are either of your companies interested in either call it cell culturing or perhaps even, like this would be sort of farther down the road, maybe even cell-free manufacturing of specific protein molecules instead of going for the sort of whole organism route? Or do you think you'll always kind of focus on the whole organism thing and then work with and other sort of companies who come up in the future might work with some of those other materials?
You can go first, Jeffrey. Let me take this.
That is a Pat Brown question, I think. our chief R&D officer, and I'm interested what he would say. I actually don't have the answer about whether we would consider that. Dan, you might know.
I can go for weeks on this if we want to. Generally speaking, like yes, never say never to anything. I am thoroughly unconvinced on the economics and scalability of those alternate technologies at this point in time. But we'd certainly look at them. I would say the one thing, and I haven't ever said this publicly, but we do this. Internally, we have a running white paper of like, what makes this work or not work as a business at scale for an arbitrary new material that me and my co-founder, who have 12 years of experience doing this, have put together. And that guides a lot of our selection process and process design when we bring a new product to market. And I would note that with Milo, it's not a secondary metabolite or a purified metabolite from a material. It is a whole organism making filamentous fibers that we're using that's then dead to make the material. So over time, we've skewed away from the more sophisticated purified biotechnology because the cost and the scalability just go to hell pretty quick.
What about with B-cell?
We do it for there, but it's because you get a specific material benefit you cannot get any other way. So you can tolerate the increased sophistication and cost basis to do that scale up. Also, you know, it's a big industry, but it's not nearly as big as leather or fibers.
Yeah.
Hi, thanks for the great session. I'm Andrea, and I'm interested in knowing, especially from Milo and Pandora, because your products sometimes, I mean, it has to do with, especially in the fashion industry, I think you're both in the lifestyle and fashion industries, there's a lot of it that has to do with the scarcity. For example, diamonds are diamonds because they're scarce. And, you know, leather also for, you know, big brands that cost a lot of money because leather is hard to work with. How do you plan to keep the status of the products when there won't be so much scarcity?
Yeah, it's a super question. So if you look at a lab-created diamond, it has all of the things that we've come to appreciate about diamonds. You know, they have the allure, they have the beauty and the shine, the cut, the polishing. It's exactly as we know it, but what we're doing is we're changing, you know, how we use diamonds. There's that saying that diamonds are forever, right? Now what we like to do is diamonds, as you would say here in Austin, Texas, therefore all y'all, right? So that's it's a change in how you view the product, but it's maintaining the magic around it, and what we see, of course, which is super exciting, is that consumers are connecting to this material with a new story, a new origin story that is for them as magical as they would have had from a traditional diamond.
For the other side of fashion, for leather goods, I'd make two points. One, as a new technology, we are constantly, like, we can do things that more like a technology company, where we're constantly inventing new versions of the product. Think like you get a product, like a consumer electronics product, and that drives, I think, new features and functionality that drive the market forward, rather than saying we have the thing, we keep it behind the fence and only let a few out. We think it's a terrible model. I think that's part of how we got here in fashion today. I'd also say that a lot of the scarcity is around the product level than the materials level when they do the best, when this is most successful, right? You know, the most famous accessory out there for scarcity is the Birkin by Hermes. You know, Hermes has 0.0% chance of someone stealing that market because the scarcity is in a specific product they make on their brand, not anything else. It's not the materials. You know, it's a stupidly high margin, right? 99.8% or something like that. And so, like, they use the highest quality materials for that, as does fashion, especially at the high end, for almost everything. But I don't think it's truly the scarcity of the materials there. I think it's the product they're making, right? You see this in sneakerhead culture as well. Need limit.
Yeah.
Hi. Thanks so much for what you do and for the talk. So basically, I spend my time building direct-to-consumer brands, and sometimes I find, like, very hard sustainability with really the scalability and also the volumes that you start producing these, like, small startups with. I've been a fan of Milo for some time, and I actually reached out in the past, and unfortunately all your allocation was, allocated to all these big brands. And obviously, like, you know, I would like to produce with mm-hmm. your product, but it's not possible because you already have the allocation. As you mentioned, it's hard really to scale in a way. So, my question to you, Dan, is really like, when do you think, you know, like, if there's actually a program within your mm-hmm. company to, you know, support small entrepreneurs on one side, on the other side, I wanted to ask you about, like, the patents, really, because you were saying, like, potentially, like, you can actually train people to produce your product in other factories around the world and other people that are actually interested in producing Milo around the world.
For the second one, we train farmers to grow the mycelium. The step where you make it into Milo turns out to be incredibly hard to train, so we end up building it ourselves, unfortunately. I wish we could just train existing CapEx to do it, which is the problem with which is what slows us down from scaling quickly. To your first question, it's a great question. We toil on this internally a lot. We actually have a program for supplying small brands who want to work with the material and local creators. It's gone through three names, so I don't want to like butcher it and like someone's filming this in the back for us and like my marketing people are going to kill me if I use the wrong name. But there is a program. But the problem is it's probably going to be oversubscribed as well in and of itself. The hope there, the get out of jail card as I see it for the industry, is build more supply, which we're doing. We built a big factory in Europe that's coming online, that finished last year, coming online this year, which will start to alleviate those supply problems. Although millions of square feet against billions of square feet of demand possible is we're gonna live in this purgatory for a while, is my guess.
Thank you.
Hi, I won't make questions, but just comments. I'm a market researcher and a brand strategist from Brazil. I think you all will succeed, but you could speed up, like for Impossible Food, not only targeting, forget the haters, but not only targeting people that don't want to eat meat, because you can eat meat, less meat, exchanging with Impossible Food, that's perfect, and you help. It's gonna be a win-win. Fashion is going to be, you will do great, because the innovators always look fashion as a trend, and when you ride a Tesla, and you feel very comfortable in a coach that is not leather, and it's very okay. And for Pandora, you use a positioning as affordable luxurious, right? And I would say a fair trade luxury, because we can't forget the blood, the Leonardo DiCaprio film that was released in 2006. Maybe most of you, they're very young, didn't see. You should see, because I'm from Brazil, and slavery in mining is something terrible, and it happens until now, as slavery in cotton happens as well. So when I know this track is called climate change, but when you think that sustainability is a triple, it's people, climate, environment, and governance. So imagine that consumers are people. I would ask for everybody that carries a diamond on your hand, where does the diamond come from? How this diamond was mined and arrived into you? So see this movie. What is the name of the movie?
Blood Diamond.
Blood Diamond, yeah. It's very interesting. So when I saw that movie in 2006, I love Leonardo DiCaprio for many other things. No, it's not for the... My husband's much more beautiful, and he's an artist, very talented, but I really like Leonardo DiCaprio. I think he's very cool artist. I never bought a single jewelry after I saw that movie. But now I'm afraid to buy silver, I'm afraid to buy gold, and especially precious diamonds and other stones. So Pandora, you have to look another possibility for position. I know that sometimes
I'm going to have to cut us off because we are now at time and people need to use the room.
Okay, sorry.
Thank you so much.
Thank you.
All right.